Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Dr. Mark Berman has discovered the surprising connection between mind, body, and environment, with special emphasis on the natural environment. He's devoted his life to studying it, and if you sometimes feel drained, distracted, or depressed, he's identified the elements of a nature prescription that can boost your energy, sharpen your focus, change your mood, improve your mental and physical health. He also reveals how central attention is to all of these functions and how interactions with nature can restore attention. His new book is Nature in the Mind. It's both an introduction to a revolutionary new scientific field and a helpful guide to better living. Dr. Mark Berman is founder and director of the Environmental Neuroscience Laboratory, University of Chicago. He's the winner of the Association for Psychological Science Early Career Research Award and American Psychological Association Early Career Award. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at University of Chicago, as well as co-director of the Masters of Computational Social Science program. His work's been featured on CNN, NPR, many popular publications, including The New Yorker, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Newsweek, National Geographic, and others. Dr. Berman, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the program.
So, Nature in the Mind, interesting book. Want to jump in here? Let's start where you do in the book, in the preface. You talk about a seminal study, very important for you, very important for this field. It's called A Walk in the Park. Tell us about this.
Yeah. So there had been some ideas that interacting with nature could be good for people's cognitive functioning. And many of these studies, they had participants interact with nature, maybe go for a walk in nature or look at some nature pictures versus walking in a more urban environment. And what these researchers would do is they would ask participants, you know, do you feel like the walk in nature improved your cognitive abilities? And a lot of people would say, yes, I felt like the nature walk improved my cognitive abilities. But it was very subjective, and not to say that subjective measures aren't beneficial. It's important how people subjectively feel about things, but I kind of wanted to sort of test these ideas in a more quantitative way. So I teamed up with Steve Kaplan, who is a very famous environmental psychologist, and John Janitis, who is a very eminent cognitive neuroscientist, and we designed some very rigorous studies to test whether interactions with nature really do truly improve our cognitive abilities. So what we did is we brought participants into the lab and we gave them a very difficult attention and memory task called the backwards digit span task. And what this task involves is that you would hear digits out loud, like 5, 6, 7, and then you need to repeat the digits back in backwards order. So say 7, 6, 5. At 3 digits, the task is very easy, but we keep increasing the number of digits up to 9 digits. At about 5 digits, you know, the task gets very, very challenging. So we gave participants this backwards digit span task, and then we had them either walk in nature, so walk through the Ann Arbor Arboretum, or we had them walk in a more urban environment through downtown Ann Arbor. So participants went on this walk and we did 2 other interesting things. We gave participants a GPS watch so we could track them to make sure they didn't just go to Starbucks, that they actually went on the walk. And we also took participants' cell phones so that they couldn't text or chit chat while they were on the walk. So we wanted them to be very engaged on the walk. So participants went on these walks and we also gave them a map of the walk. And then participants came back to the lab and we assessed their memory and attention again with the backwards digit span task. And then a week later, participants returned to the lab. They repeated the whole procedure again, but if they walked in nature the first week, they walked in the urban environment the second week or vice versa. So we had about 40 participants in this study. And what we found was pretty incredible, that participants improved by about 20% in their working memory and attention, an objective measure of working memory and attention from this backwards digit span task after they walked in nature, but they didn't really show much of a significant improvement after walking in the urban environment. So I think our study was one of the first studies to really test whether nature can improve objective cognitive performance. And we found that it could in quite, you know, substantial ways.
So you're still studying this, right? It launched into environmental neuroscience, but just preliminarily for this discussion, what's going on there? Why did the people who walked in nature, perform better?
Yeah, so we think there's a few reasons, but one of the main theories that we're kind of working under is called attention restoration theory that was posited by one of my mentors, Steve Kaplan, and his wife, Rachel Kaplan. And one of the key tenets to attention restoration theory is that humans have two kinds of attention. One kind of attention is called directed attention. That's the kind of attention where you as an individual person decide what you're paying attention to. So, Tom, presumably you're deciding to pay attention to me and what I'm saying, even though you could probably find other things in the environment that are more interesting than what I'm saying. And it's thought that this ability to direct attention is fatigable or depletable, that you can only focus your attention for so long before you become mentally fatigued, and then you just can't focus anymore. And we've all had that sensation at the end of a long work day, maybe around 3 or 4 o'clock, where you might be just staring at the computer screen and you're just kind of mind wandering and you can't focus. That we would call a sort of a directed attention fatigue state. We think that humans also have another kind of attention that we call involuntary attention. Sometimes this is called bottom-up attention or exogenous attention. This is the kind of attention that's automatically captured by interesting stimulation in the environment. So bright lights, loud noises, those things automatically capture our attention and you don't really have control over it. And it's thought that this kind of attention is less susceptible to fatigue or depletion. So you don't often hear people say, oh, I can't look at that beautiful waterfall anymore. It's just too interesting. I can't look at it. Or, oh, I can't watch this really interesting movie anymore. It's just too interesting. I have to shut it off. So the idea behind attention restoration theory is that if you can find environments that don't place a lot of demands on directed attention while simultaneously having interesting stimulation to activate involuntary attention, you can restore or replenish this precious directed attention resource. And we think natural environments tend to meet this criteria of many natural environments, your local park. You can kind of not use so much directed attention, as long as you feel safe in the area. And there's a lot of interesting stimulation to activate involuntary attention. Now, there's one other thing that I want to mention too, which is that we think the kind of stimulation that activates involuntary attention should be what we call softly fascinating. So what do I mean by softly fascinating? By softly fascinating, I mean, when I look at that waterfall, it's very interesting. It captures my attention automatically, but it doesn't do so in an all-consuming way. I can kind of still mind wander and think about other things while looking at the waterfall. If I'm in Times Square, there's also a lot of stimulation that automatically captures my attention, but it kind of does so in a very harsh way, in an all-consuming way, where I can't really mind wander or think about other things when I'm in Times Square. So we think that the kind of stimulation that's necessary to get these benefits has to be softly fascinating to activate involuntary attention in a softly fascinating way and not in a harsh way. And we believe that a lot of natural environments have softly fascinating stimulation. Watching birds flying, watching tree leaves swaying, watching water ripple through a river, all of those things are interesting. They capture our attention. Maybe even looking at a campfire. They're all interesting. They all capture our attention, but they do so in a softly fascinating way.
Mm. Maybe this would be a good time to bring in your fascination with trees. You write about this in the book. So starting with some blue spruces on your grandparents' property in Michigan, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about this.
Yeah. So my grandparents, on my mom's side, had about 4 acres of land in Michigan. And my grandmother really liked the blue spruce tree. She kind of thought it was a fancy, kind of beautiful looking tree. And so in the front of her property, she planted these blue spruce. At the time she planted them, they were small saplings. But when I was a kid, these were gigantic trees, so big that you could almost, you could go underneath them and almost have a picnic under them. They were so large and so wide. And she was very proud of these trees, and we all found them to be really beautiful. And my mom really had a strong association with these trees. And when my grandmother sold the property, my mom made sure to get a blue spruce sapling that was around, and she planted it in our backyard in suburban Detroit, which also grew into a giant tree as well. So even though I wasn't, super conscious, I didn't say, "Oh, I love Grandma Ruth's blue spruce trees." We definitely played a lot with them, and my mom had a very strong attachment to those trees.
So you talk about running your hand over the bark, right? Watching the bugs, a lot of stimulus there. I guess those fall under the soft fascination, right? What kinds of nature fall under that this category?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of nature does, and you're right, Tom. There's multi-dimensional aspects to, what can lead to soft fascination, even the smell of nature. I remember seeing the sap from the tree kind of dripping down, or even just looking at it and how it would shimmer in the light. Nature has a lot of what are called fractal patterns, and one of the kind of characteristic ways to kind of describe what a fractal pattern means. If you imagine a snowflake has a characteristic shape. If you put that snowflake under a microscope and zoom in, it also kind of has that same shape. And if you zoom in even more, it kind of has that same shape. And we call that fractal, or it's kind of another way to call it is scale free, that it doesn't matter at what spatial scale you look at the snowflake, it has the same shape. And nature is sort of filled with this fractalness, this kind of scale-free structure. And trees, for example, have that too. You can imagine a maple tree. It's got the trunk that then branches out into branches that branch out into smaller branches that branch out into even smaller branches that branch out into the leaves. And the veins of the leaves also branch out so that the tree has this repeated pattern at all these different spatial scales. And humans like looking at fractal stimulation. We prefer it, and it might even be sort of easier for us to process. And so we think when you're in natural environments where there is a lot of fractalness, it might be good for our brains, and therefore it might be good for our cognitive performance.
This could even happen indoors, right? There's a couple of photographs in the book that stood out to me of doors. One had a lot of fractal surfaces, the other just an industrial flat door. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so nature isn't the only way to get fractalness. Designers can also design objects to have more fractalness. And we do have, as you're talking about, Tom, we do have a photograph in the book of just a plain industrial door, which just basically just has the doorway with this flat door in front of it, versus another door that has sort of molding around the door that are rectangles. And then the door itself has rectangles in it. So there, this rectangular shape is sort of repeated at these different scales. And even though there's nothing natural, more natural about the door that has more fractalness versus the one that doesn't, people prefer the door that has this fractal structure. And they actually even think of that door as being more natural than the door that's just flat. I can see in your studio you have some wood paneling on your wall that has, fractal structure. I actually have some fake plants in my office here. So we can bring a lot of these natural elements to the indoors too, and that can also have benefits to us.
What part of this is, I guess I'll get into this question this way. A lot of us, live our lives in our minds. We just, we're very much in our heads and our minds. Sometimes you have to do that, right? Is there something about nature that kind of gets you out of that? And is that beneficial?
Well, it's possible, and maybe for a number of different ways. So we did do a study with participants who were suffering from clinical depression. In some ways, you could think of them as being sort of the most in their heads and having this depressive rumination where unfortunately, these participants are ruminating about negative thoughts and feelings over and over again. And we did a study with participants who've been suffering from clinical depression, kind of with the same procedure as the walk in the park study that I described earlier, except before these participants went on the walk, we also had them think about a negative thought or memory before they went on the walk to kind of induce this rumination. And we thought at first, maybe going for a walk alone in nature, if you're ruminating, it might not be helpful for depression at all. It might actually exacerbate depression. Maybe it increases rumination. But we found actually just the opposite. The effects of walking in nature for these participants who are suffering from depression had stronger effects. So their memory and attention actually improved more than our non-clinical sample when they went for the walk in nature. So it was very, very beneficial to them. So why is that so beneficial? Well, if you're suffering from depression and you're ruminating so much, it hurts your attention and it hurts your ability to focus. And if interacting with nature improves your ability to focus, improves your ability to direct attention, we think that's one reason why it can be very beneficial for people suffering from things like depression and anxiety. We also find that when people interact with nature, they actually tend to think less about themselves and more about others. And we think that's very interesting that, and even in nature, often there's not as many people around, but people actually think more about other people in these environments, which made people sort of less inwardly self-focused and sort of more attentive to the external world. And that could also be beneficial for things like depression, but it could also be beneficial in terms of thinking about improving cooperation or helping people to be less selfish and things like that. In fact, other people have shown that interacting, especially with beautiful nature, can give people a sense of awe, which kind of makes them feel a bit small in comparison to the rest of the world. And while that might not seem positive, it actually can be positive in the sense that you sort of see things in more perspective. Again, you're not so egocentric, and you really can get a sense of the awe or beauty that exists in the world, but particularly in nature.
And you point out, I want to emphasize this. You've pointed out in the book, and in articles, that for example, depression. You should take the prescribed medicine. The therapies, etc. That this is a supplemental help. Nature is.
Right. So, we don't think at this point that interacting with nature should replace pharmacological interventions for depression or anxiety or talk therapy, but we do view interacting with nature as being a supplement to those therapies. And as I mentioned before, we found that interacting with nature was very beneficial for participants suffering from clinical depression. Other researchers have found that interacting with nature can reduce depressive rumination. People have found that interacting with nature, in particular for kids, was really good at reducing symptoms of ADHD, like inattention. So we think that, interacting with nature, while not a silver bullet, can be used as a way to alleviate a lot of mental illnesses. More work needs to be done to see, how does it compare to more traditional therapies, but there's no harm in going out in nature. And in fact, in the UK, they now prescribe, medical professionals now prescribe nature walks for people suffering from depression. In Canada, they also prescribe interactions, walks in nature as a way to be a therapy for depression. So it might sound impossible. Like, how could a walk in nature be beneficial for things like depression and anxiety? But the data shows that, in fact, it is quite beneficial.
Well, let's take a break. We're talking with Dr. Mark Berman. The book is Nature and the Mind. We're talking about the field of environmental neuroscience and exactly Dr. Berman studies how nature helps, how nature affects our mind. A lot of beneficial effects. We'll talk more about it following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Dr. Mark Berman. He's founder and director of the Environmental Neuroscience Laboratory at University of Chicago, author of the new book, Nature and the Mind. So, Dr. Berman, I think you mentioned in the book O. Henry's story, The Last Leaf. I think we're many of us familiar with this. The main person in the story has a friend who's dying, or at least they think they're dying, and they're going to wait until that last leaf through the window falls, and then they're going to give up, right? And so in the story, this friend paints a leaf, right? And the friend ends up having the will to live. I guess what that's leading me to is, if nature is medicine, what's the dosage? Looking at a tree through the window, or do you have to get out into nature, and how much?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's a little bit of all of that. So maybe I'll start with one of the most impressive studies that was done in the 1980s by Roger Ulrich. And Roger Ulrich was studying a single hospital corridor in a hospital in Philadelphia, and he was looking at patients' recovery from gallbladder surgery. And it so happened that on this single corridor in this hospital in Philadelphia, some hospital rooms just happened to have a view of some nature, like some trees or some bushes. And then other rooms on the hospital corridor had views of just like a brick wall or asphalt. And what Ulrich found is really incredible, that the patients who had the views of nature, they recovered from gallbladder surgery about a day earlier, and they used less pain medication than the patients who had the view of the brick wall, which is just incredible. And, listeners might be thinking, well, maybe the people that had the nature views were healthier or wealthier people or more educated. But no, that wasn't the case. These patients are just randomly assigned to these rooms by which room is available. So it's kind of like an experiment where you're just putting people into these different rooms and seeing how that impacts recovery. And it turns out having just a view of nature can be, salubrious for physical healing, which is just incredible, and kind of relates to the O. Henry story a little bit. Obviously, there's a lot of questions. So why would having nature out of your window have this healing ability? Well, I don't think in the case of the Ulrich study, it has to do with air quality. I don't think it has to do with, having nature out of your window, encouraging patients to exercise more or something like that. It has to do somehow with the aesthetic of nature. So it could be that, again, having those fractal patterns outside of your window and seeing those, could have brain benefits that then lead to body benefits, because, mind and body are not separate. It also could be, too, that just having the nature view was nicer. And so maybe it improved those patients' moods, which then might improve healing. So the exact mechanisms aren't clear, but it's amazing to know that just having a view of nature out of your window can speed healing. And people now, hospital designers, have taken Roger Ulrich's work seriously, and they've tried to incorporate more nature into hospitals. And I think that has actually been a movement to do that. People have also found that seeing nature, showing people nature video can also reduce feelings of pain for different kinds of procedures. And then we found that having more nature in your neighborhood can be beneficial for cardiovascular diseases or cardiometabolic conditions. So we did a study in Toronto where we had this incredible data set where the University of Toronto Forestry Department actually labeled every single tree on public land in the city of Toronto. So 580,000 trees in the city of Toronto. We knew the species of the tree and the diameter of the tree at breast height, which told us the age of the tree. And then one of my students, Omid Cardan, used some forestry algorithms to calculate how much tree canopy each individual tree would provide. And then we had health data from about 30,000 people in Toronto. And we found that having about 11 trees on the street could reduce cardiometabolic disorders, so stroke, diabetes, and heart disease, by about 1%, controlling for age, education, and income. So that sounds pretty modest, but to actually get that 1% decrease monetarily, you'd have to give every household in that neighborhood about $20,000 and have them all move to a neighborhood that's about $20,000 wealthier, or also make people about 1.5 years younger. So it's pretty incredible that just increasing tree canopy modestly had these health benefits. For those studies, we think maybe that has to do with air quality or encouraging people to exercise, but it could also be due to, again, the aesthetic of nature, that having these fractal patterns, having the beauty of nature around, is good for our brains, which will then be good for our bodies.
Here's a study, a Finnish study. When children played outside among plants, they experienced a significant boost to their immune systems after 28 days. That's incredible.
Yes. Yeah, that's incredible too. And for those studies, there might be another element, which has to do with the microbiome, or the little microbes that are in nature. So when these kids were playing outside in nature and getting their hands in the dirt, some of these microbes are entering the body through the nose, but they're also probably putting their hands in their mouth a little bit too. So they're ingesting some of these microbes, and these are good microbes that actually help to boost immune function. So these kids had better immune responses and were less likely to get sick. So here's just another added benefit of having nature, that it can actually improve the immune system as well.
Here's one. Exposure to natural light benefits eye health. So nature can improve your eyesight.
Yes. So people find that going outdoors more and exposing yourself to natural light actually reduces myopia and the need for glasses. And again, it's just incredible. And this is really important, because as so many of us, and especially kids, are now staring at screens at close view, rates of myopia are starting to rise. But what these researchers have found is that actually, if you can get the kids outside and maybe outside in nature and getting them exposed to the natural light, you can actually reduce the risk of myopia. So it's, you know, again, it's just another reason why it's important to get outside, and in particular to get outside in nature.
We talked about attention, right? The importance of attention and the deficits of attention. Tell me a little bit more about how nature improves our focus.
Yeah, and we should also start too with sort of our inability to focus as well, maybe now compared to how we used to focus. There have been some ideas that globally people's attention spans have kind of shrunk. So for example, these researchers found that the popularity of movies, like the top selling movies, it used to be that a top selling movie would be the top movie for about 5 months. And now that's being reduced to 3 months. Or that hashtag tweets from Twitter, you know, the top ones used to last for 20 hours, now they only last for 11 hours. And this suggests sort of a global shrinking of our focus or our ability to just sort of stay on one task. And it's hard now because there are so many things in our environment that are vying for our attention. You know, social media, surfing the internet, streaming services, all of these things are vying for our attention and trying to capture our attention and not let it go. You know, I don't want to vilify these corporations, but they make money from keeping you on your devices for as long as possible. And we and others think that that is very problematic for attention. And in fact, other researchers have shown, for example, people that are what are so-called multimedia multitaskers, so people that are sort of surfing the web while texting, that doesn't sort of train our attention and make us better attention. It actually hurts our attention and makes it more difficult to focus. So humans now are having a lot of trouble focusing. And you might think, well, what's so important about that? Yeah, I'm not as productive at work, or maybe I won't do as well in school, but you know, maybe that's not such a big deal. But we actually think that this ability to direct attention and to focus, it's not just about doing well in school or being productive at work. It's actually also about self-control and aggression and meeting our goals, that we think this ability to direct attention is important for resisting impulses, not acting on urges, being more cooperative, being able to plan for the future. And when our attention shrinks, people become more irritated. They don't plan for the future as well. They become more impulsive, and they may even become more aggressive. So we think attention is really, really critical for successful human functioning. And a lot of modern technology is kind of depleting our attention. But luckily, we're finding that interacting with nature can restore or improve our attention. So, you know, I'm not advocating that people throw away their devices, but I am saying that a lot of activities that people think are restful, you know, potentially like scrolling the internet or scrolling through your social media feed, a lot of people think that that's sort of a restful activity. And we're saying, no, that isn't a restful activity. It's actually depleting. And when you feel like you can't focus, and you're mentally fatigued, don't go on your device. We recommend that you actually go out in nature, interact with nature.
I'm recalling I think you describe a friend in the book who went from on our daily jog, went from iPod to iPhone, right? A lot of us remember when we did that transition. And with the iPod, it was music, you know, the playlist, whatever. When she went to the iPhone, it was everything. She brought everything with her, right? On the jog, right? I guess that's an argument for at least turning your phone off while you're in nature.
And you know, if you want the walk to be, you know, as restorative as possible, you probably want to go alone, and you don't want to have, you know, earbuds in your ears. You want to be listening to the sounds of nature and having all of that experience. I remember Steve Kaplan kind of joking with me, although I think he was only half joking, you know, when iPods were popular and you saw all these students on campus just walking around campus with their earbuds in. And Steve Kaplan mentioned to me, you know, look at how uncomfortable people are with their own thoughts. And that really stayed with me. And I think, you know, people do have a lot of discomfort just kind of being alone with their thoughts. But we think being in nature can actually help you to be alone with your thoughts and to maybe do some productive cognitive work while you're in nature. So you definitely, when you're interacting with nature, we want you to be fully engaged with nature, not distracted by your phone or music or anything else. We want to have your full attention in nature. Now, you know, I love taking my kids out in nature and getting them out in nature, but if I want to have a restful, restored nature experience, I have to go by myself. I can't bring my kids. So this is a time to actually take care of yourself and to have a little me time in nature where it's just you and the environment. Now, one thing we haven't touched on yet is that while we think interacting with real nature is the best. You can also get some of these benefits from looking at pictures of nature, or listening to nature sounds, or looking at nature out of your window. So if you don't have easy access to nature, we think that some of this simulated nature, or looking out of your window, if you have a nature view, can also have benefits too.
Yeah, that's helpful, right? Because not everybody has access to nature as we would call it, right?
That's right. That's right. So it's nice to know that some of these simulations of nature can also lead to benefits, but I'm also, I wouldn't want to go too extreme there and say, oh, because you can get benefits from artificial nature, we could destroy the current nature that we have. No. We still think you're going to get the biggest benefits from actual nature, but it's nice to know that if you don't have access, that you can get these benefits from artificial nature.
One more little item before we go to another break. I joke with my friends that I like the great indoors, right? And I do like a little nature, but I further joke with them that my favorite way to enjoy nature is driving through nature with the window rolled down to get the benefits. Not that I don't like nature, but so this section stood out to me. We can get the benefits even if we don't like nature. Tell me about that.
Yes. So if we recall the walk in the park study where we had participants take that backwards digit-span task and then go for a walk in nature and then return to the lab and do the backwards digit-span task again, or they had participants who came to lab, they did the backwards digit-span task, or they had a walk in an urban environment and then came back to the lab to look for changes. We had people walk at, well, first, maybe I should say, we also recorded people's mood. And people tended to show increases in mood after the walk in nature compared to the urban walk. But we didn't see much of a strong correlation between improvements in mood and improvements in cognitive performance. So it wasn't just the case that the people who showed the biggest improvements in the backwards digit-span task were also the ones who showed the biggest mood benefit. But that's just correlational. An even stronger demonstration that this wasn't all mood driven and you don't have to like nature to get the cognitive benefit was that we had participants walk at different times of the year. So some participants walked in June when it was about 80 degrees Fahrenheit in Ann Arbor. Participants loved the walk in nature. They said, "Mark, I can't believe you're paying me to go for a walk in nature." They showed really healthy mood benefits and really healthy cognitive benefits. We also had some participants walk in January when it was about 25 degrees Fahrenheit. Participants said, "Mark, I was freezing my butt off out there. I did not like that walk in nature." So they didn't get the mood benefits, but those people that walked in January showed the same cognitive improvements as the people that walked in June. So their improvements in directed attention were just as good walking in nature in January as walking in June, suggesting that you don't have to like the nature interaction to get these cognitive benefits. And that was a pretty counterintuitive finding because a lot of people kind of thought, well, maybe this is all driven by, people just being happier in nature and then that just leads to everything improving. But that doesn't seem to be the case that you can get these benefits even if you don't like the nature interaction. You do have to like the nature interaction to get the mood benefit. But you don't have to like the nature interaction to get these cognitive, these attention and memory benefits. So I think that's really, really interesting. And you hear often people say, "Well, I'm a city person. I don't like nature." And what these results are suggesting is that maybe that doesn't really matter. That this is a pretty fundamental aspect of human nature that. That we all can get these benefits to cognitive functioning, to brain functioning from interacting with nature. Now, I will say there are probably limits. So, for example, sometimes, when we're submitting papers for publication, I get these cheeky reviewers that say, "Well, what if there's a wildfire? What if you're in nature and you're being chased by a bear?" I would say, "Well, of course, I don't think you're going to get those benefits because you're going to use a hell of a lot of directed attention if there's a wildfire if being chased by a bear." If you're totally not dressed appropriately for the weather and you're so uncomfortable, yeah, I don't think the nature is going to be beneficial. But going on a rainy day or going when it's overcast, I don't think it's going to matter in terms of the cognitive benefit. And saying that you're just a city person, you don't like nature, I don't think that's really going to matter either. As long as you have a minimum threshold that you feel safe and you don't have to use direct attention, we believe that that nature interaction is going to have cognitive benefits for you.
Yeah, I guess it's good news for parents who are trying to get their kids out of the gaming console and out in some sunshine, right? Yeah. Even if
Absolutely,
the kids don't like
absolutely.
it, they'll benefit.
Absolutely. And maybe it's kind of like broccoli, you know.
Yes, yeah, you're
It
right.
might not taste great, but it's good for you.
Yeah, and they might come to like it later on.
Right, that's right.
Let's take another break. We'll be back with the final segment with Dr. Mark Berman. He is founder and director of the Environmental Neuroscience Laboratory, University of Chicago, the author of a new book. It's called Nature and the Mind. We'll have more following this. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to have Dr. Mark Berman on the program today. He's founder and director of the Environmental Neuroscience Laboratory at the University of Chicago. He's out with a new book, Nature and the Mind. Dr. Berman, I want to get now to, I guess, one of my favorite parts of the book. This is an incredible true story from Vietnam. A Vietnamese architect had a friend who was depressed. And I guess it illustrates that you can bring nature to yourself, right? So this architect designed a house for his friend. Tell me about this.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. So this architect from Vietnam, Vo Trong Nhien, designed this house for his friend who was suffering from depression, and he called it the House for Trees. And basically, it looks like you can see in the book, we have pictures of the house, these planter boxes for each room. And on top, like of the roof of each room, was like a banyan tree. So it's like all these kind of large planter boxes. And to get from one room to the other, you had to go outside and be out kind of in this nature. From these banyan trees. And initially, the architect's friend was furious with him that this was so inconvenient to have to walk outside to go to other rooms, like to go from the living room to the kitchen or bedroom to the kitchen. But over time, his friend's depression alleviated, and he didn't have depression anymore. And this friend actually then moved to a more conventional house. But when he moved to the more conventional house, his depression returned. So then he quickly moved back to the house for trees. And it's, to me, it's a really beautiful example of kind of what we call like environmental neuroscience, you know, how the environment affects our behavior, where this home environment was purposely designed that you could not really avoid nature. And it had these really strong mental health benefits for this individual. So, you know, as we talk in the later part of the book, you know, we kind of want to start what we're kind of calling a nature revolution, where we want people to really take this work seriously, and that, you know, it applies to our homes, to our schools, to our offices, even to entire cities, that we want to be designing with nature in mind and trying to get more nature into all of these spaces that we think are going to have really, really large scale health benefits, both physical health benefits and mental health benefits. And when I talk to people a lot about this, you know, a lot of people think that nature is nice and they like nature, but often they think about nature as being an amenity and not a necessity. You know, having jobs, of course, is a necessity. Having good health care is a necessity. But having nature nearby, that seems more like an amenity. You know, if we can afford it, we can have it. Or maybe it all is just for wealthy people, it's not for everybody. And I think what we're suggesting and other people are suggesting is that no, actually, having more nature nearby is not an amenity, it's a necessity. We have to have it. And when we don't have it, we suffer and we can't reach our full potential maybe without having nature nearby. So this doesn't mean that we want people to leave the cities and move, elsewhere. Cities are good for a lot of reasons. They're more sustainable, and we find in other aspects of our work that there's economic advantages to city, and there's actually lower rates of depression in cities, lower racial biases in cities. But we want to sort of naturize the cities. We want to bring more nature into the cities. We want to bring more nature into our homes. We want to bring more nature into our schools. We want to bring more nature into our workplaces. And I think it doesn't mean just building more parks and planting more trees. It might also mean sort of designing our days differently. I keep hearing, and even in my kids' schools, they want to take away recess. They want to shorten recess. They want to have more instruction time. And I think what our research is showing is that that's not really the right way to be thinking about things. Yes, we want to have plenty of instruction, but you also want to design in break time, and those break times we want to be in nature. So imagine, for example, instead of an 8-hour day of straight instruction, what if you gave the kids 6.5 hours of instruction, but also gave them 1.5 hours break in nature? It's possible that that actually might lead to better learning than to have 8 hours straight of instruction. So, and that also applies to work places as well. So it's not just about incorporating more nature into our homes and schools and workplaces, which I think we should do, but it's also about designing these nature breaks into our days.
You mentioned it, interesting in the book, you mentioned Stockholm. You like, that's a good example, right? You've been there. Singapore is another good example. And you mentioned, I guess, that it takes the public will, that Amsterdam wasn't always a biking city. It was a car city before. These things can happen, right? If we put our minds to it.
That's right. So they can change. Stockholm, which I've been to, benefits from being very close to the water and having this beautiful set of islands. But they also incorporate the nature very well integrated into the city. And oftentimes this is easier in European cities because they were built before automobiles. But as you said, Amsterdam was not, in the 60s and 70s, looked more like a car city than a biking city. But they made changes. They said, we don't like this. We want to change it. And they did. And now Amsterdam is a fantastic biking and walking city, a very pedestrian-friendly city. And I think you kind of have to be a little bit more pedestrian-friendly to also get the benefits of nature. So I talk about one example from the book. Near the campus of the University of Chicago are these beautiful parks, Jackson Park, the Midway Plaisance, and Washington Park. They were designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, who was also the landscape architect who designed Central Park. But the problem with Jackson Park, Washington Park, and Midway Plaisance in Chicago is that there's a lot of car traffic that's right by these parks. So it's very noisy, and you have to use a lot of directed attention across the streets and things like that. So I remember one time walking in Jackson Park with my kids, and literally a hubcap flew off of a wheel of a car and spun around in front of us. And I thought, yeah, this is really ruining the park. So, again, you have to make the park sort of pedestrian friendly, where they're more kind of secluded from the noise of car traffic and things like that are going to use up directed attention.
Just a minute left. What would you like the takeaway to be from from this book, and from this discussion?
I guess a couple things. So one, I would say that the environment in general has a really significant impact on our behavior, and humans tend to ignore that because we have so much control over the environment. But it doesn't mean that we're immune to the environment. And because we have so much control over the environment, we can actually do a lot to improve the environment. So I think a lot of our environments were not designed to lower depression or make people more cooperative or improve attention. They were designed to like move goods efficiently and house people efficiently. So I would like us to kind of change our mindset here to say, actually, hey, we can actually make these environments better for human, memory and attention by incorporating more nature in them. I think another thing is that nature is not an amenity, it's a necessity. We have to have it, and we have to make it easily accessible so that we can use it, and we have to make time to use it. I guess another thing to say is, like, when we're mentally fatigued, scrolling the internet or scrolling your news feeds and social media is not going to be restorative. When you feel mentally drained or fatigued, it's best to go for the walk in nature, and you don't have to like the walk in nature to get the benefit.
Well, interesting discussion, interesting book. Dr. Mark Berman is founder and director of the Environmental Neuroscience Laboratory, University of Chicago. The new book is Nature and the Mind. Dr. Berman, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.